Heron, Ron Heron for AM 1290.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel, and Diane Duva and I are your hosts every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11, and Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara. And Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Hi, Neil. How was your weekend?
My weekend was great. It is cool and beautiful in Santa Barbara.
You missed a great Library Foundation gala. The library was lit up. If anyone saw it, it looked beautiful.
You are an active board member of the...
No, I'm no longer a board member. I'm just a volunteer.
Oh, well, you do good things for this community.
I try.
So the first article we have today is about mutual fund taxes that I think most people who invest in mutual funds are aware of, that all of the capital gains that are distributed for tax purposes to holders of mutual funds are done at a date certain, usually the third week in December. So one of the problems with owning a mutual fund is that you could buy a mutual fund and actually lose money in the year that you own it, but still pay a capital gains tax if the fund sold stocks at a profit. Well, what is new this year and what this article is looking at, this is in today's Wall Street Journal, is that there's been a seminal change in individual desire to own not mutual funds, but exchange-traded funds. And the shift, people selling their mutual funds to buy exchange-traded funds, has resulted in a need for the mutual fund industry to raise cash to pay for these redemptions. And the way they've been raising cash is partly selling stocks that have a capital gain.
And part of it is because this year has been a good year for stocks, and so most of the stocks have a capital gain embedded in them.
So, exactly. And so there's going to be, in many cases, very large capital gains. So if you are a owner of a mutual fund, and worst case, if you decide to buy a mutual fund today, you may end up paying for a very large amount of capital gains in December that you did not participate in that appreciation.
Well, let's quantify that very large. Is what they're estimates for most mutual funds are somewhere in the 3 to 7%. They don't actually know until probably mid to late November what that capital gain is going to be, but it's going to be somewhere in the 3 to 7% range. So it's going to be large, but it might not be as large as, you know, 50% of what you own.
That's true, but the article did have a table that showed some of the funds that did have pretty large exposures, and some of them were as high as 27%. So it would be worth taking a look at this Wall Street Journal article if you do own.
Absolutely,
a mutual fund.
Because the X date hasn't happened yet. So the date that you have to own the that you own the mutual fund that they distribute those gains has not passed yet. So if you take a look at what you're holding, and you could figure that out or estimate.
Yeah, and remember, this is not the traditional way people look at capital gains. The fund does not have to distribute the cash to you. They just recognize the capital gain. So in a way, it's sort of phantom income.
That said, though, most mutual funds do distribute that money to you.
But this time they may not, because they've been using it to pay for redemptions. So it's an open question. The next article, I think you will be able to add some value, and I certainly got some value out of it because I got a good laugh, is also in today's Wall Street Journal, and it says, why couples should see a financial advisor before they get married. And one of the better quotes is that a fellow who is a a Beverly Hills investment advisor says we're now more psychologists than we are financial planners. And what many, and there's a bunch of interviews here about financial planners talking to, whether it's a young couple or an old couple, about having a meeting of the minds about their financial discipline and their financial risk-taking and how much each person should bring to the party is a if it's not dealt with, there could be real problems, not just financially, but with the marriage as well.
So, right, and money tends to be the number one reason why people start having problems in their marriage. And so if you do, if you are looking to get married, if you sit down with somebody and talk through each of the spouses or partners' viewpoint towards money, how they handle money, how they budget, how they spend money, you know, it's kind of like going to marriage counseling. You know, you just deal with those issues along the way instead of being surprised 5-10 years into your marriage.
So how does this resonate with you? Do you have clients that come in before they get married?
I have met with young couples and older couples who are looking to either get married or not get married or are just together. I often say, you know, you shouldn't get married or not married due to money. You should get married or not married due to love.
And how many people, when they walk out of there, still get married?
Most.
Good.
Yes.
That's good. So the next article is about the current tax proposal that the Republicans have put forth. And this is in the New York Times on Saturday. And basically it says, look, don't do anything, because first of all, we're not going to really know if this or anything else is going to get passed.
And I think that is the best advice on anything that people are talking about coming out of Congress, because you just don't know until it happens what the facts are going to be. And there's no real way to plan for the unknown.
And there are two points that they make that should give some people pause to make a decision, like you said, shouldn't be done just on a proposal. And that is, and I remember this, in 1986, with the last big change in the tax code, they eliminated the deductibility of credit card interest. And I remember people saying, no one's going to use a credit card anymore, no one's going to have credit with a credit card anymore. And that never happened, because people just adjusted to that reality, the lack of deductibility for credit card interest. It actually made life easier, because you didn't have to take every one of your receipts and add up the amount of taxes that you, the amount of interest that you paid on that tax, on that credit card.
Well, good financial planning advice would be to pay off your credit card.
Yes, that's true. And the other thing, which is really a long-term issue, which should be thought about, is the whole idea of deciding whether to have a Roth IRA or whether to have a traditional IRA or whether to have a 401k based on the current tax changes that are being proposed. Because it's very possible that over the next 20, 30 years, when people are about ready to retire, they're going to,
some changes to the tax code.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of it is my advice to people is, regardless of what's going on in Washington, you need to make decisions for your own retirement. And so whether you save in a 401k or a Roth, or ideally both and all of them, you're really saving for your retirement, to live better in retirement. Because it's unclear what safety nets and social services will be available to us.
Right. And the point that they make is that it's possible, you know, Roth IRAs are the benefit is that you don't pay taxes in the future taxes.
Right.
But that
so you
may
pay
change.
You pay tax today, and then when you take it out, you don't pay a tax. Whereas with a traditional IRA, you get a tax deduction today, and then when you take it out, you're taxed on all that tax-deferred growth.
Yeah, but the article said things that we never thought would be changed could be changed, and they could start taxing Roth IRAs in 20 years. So you shouldn't just make a decision based upon what's taking place today. And the final article that we have is sort of a paradox here, and this is in Saturday's Wall Street Journal, and it talks about the fact that sales of most companies in America are doing very, very well. But there are two things they point out. That roughly 50% of the sales of the S&P has been a result of foreign earnings, of foreign operations. And the second thing is that
I think it's important on the foreign earnings is that really this has been a global a global rise in markets. It hasn't just been a U.S. rally. In years past, when the stock market here has done well, overseas hasn't done as well. This truly has been a global rally for all markets.
I know, and people will tell you that they're invested in the S&P 500 because they believe in America. Well, more than half the earnings of the S&P is coming from outside of America. But the other thing that's interesting is the warning in this article is that, look, you know, if you have increase in sales, you're going to end up with an increase in costs, too, because commodity prices are going up, fuel, all of the, you know, iron, steel, all of the things that go into building things have been rising in the last 6 months. And so unless you get productivity gains, you're going to get a margin squeeze possibly. So you just can't look at sales growth. And so there may be some pressure on the cost side that people have to take a look at. And unless there's productivity gains we haven't seen the last couple of years, there could be some problems down the road.
And you know, with that article also, as you have profits rising, the hope is that we'll start to see some wage pressure to the upside. And that will also help in terms of having more money and more spending, consumer spending in the economy.
So a final thought. My wife and I see a marriage counselor. Should we see you instead and we get two birds with one stone?
Sometimes it does feel like I should have my marriage your counseling degree.
Right.
But
you're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
It's a fact. Successful wealth management is built on strategies that focus on the big picture, take a long-term view, and establish deep and valued relationships. Hello, I'm Diane Duva, founding partner at Arlington Financial Advisors, Santa Barbara's trusted family guide, empowering you to make more informed and confident decisions. At Arlington Financial Advisors, we bring order and balance to your financial life by monitoring and managing risk so you can focus on your work, family, and enjoying the moment. We are a fully independent firm offering strategic financial planning, estate and tax planning, and private money management. Our plans and portfolios are handcrafted using a rigorous and disciplined approach, supported by a consistent yet highly personalized client experience. Our clients look to Arlington Financial Advisors as a home away from home, a comfortable place to protect what they've accomplished while they prepare for what comes next. Please visit arlingtonfinancialadvisors.com or call me, Diane Duva, at 805-699-7300.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner. And we can be reached at 564-1290.
Or you could email us at moneytalk1290@gmail.com. And we have in studio with us today Lyle Turner, who's a biochemist, entrepreneur, and founder of Invitrogen. Welcome, Lyle. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure, Diane. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes. So, you know, tell us a little bit about you. How did you, you know, how did you end up in California, and how did you end up interested in biochemistry?
I'm a farm boy from Iowa that was always interested in science. I came out here looking for work in the early 70s after I got out of high school, and I was kind of living under the radar from the draft system back in those days, and decided that wasn't a long-term strategy. I liked science, and I thought medicine would be a good career move, so I went into the Navy as a medic corpsman, went to medical school, or not medical school, but their medical core school in San Diego. Their pharmacy technician school in San Diego. And when I got out of the Navy, I stayed in San Diego and went to UCSD and got my degree in chemistry. Tried to get into medical school, didn't get in. I pulled a Forrest Gump and took off on my bicycle and rode across the United States, waiting for my heart to heal from missing out on medical school. And then found a job in a startup biotech company, and then I just moved from startup biotech to startup until I started my own in the late 80s. And
so how did you go about starting your own company? A lot of our listeners are, you know, Santa Barbara is a hotbed for technology and startups and thinking about that idea and how to go from idea to company.
I made a little bit of money in stock options at the biotech company that I was working for. So I had some seed capital of my own. I worked in business development at that company, and it turned me off of using other people's money to start companies. It just seemed like you get on a track and you spend other people's money, and then you have to go find some more, and then you're spending all your time managing either raising
the
money
investors,
or managing the investors. And I didn't like that path, so I saved up my own money. And another gentleman, a scientist there at Centro Corporation was the name of the company he worked for. He had a product idea. I left Centro and I went to work for a biochemical supply company. And I was traveling around as a sales rep for Boehringer Mannheim Biochemicals. And I reported to them that our customers were asking for kits, pre-set up systems so that they could go into those systems just like Pillsbury cake mix, like the
okay.
Betty Crocker
Just add
cookie.
The eggs and water.
Add your eggs or your DNA sample or your tissue sample and isolate the DNA and, you know, then a little chemistry by numbers set that took them through complex procedures. And my customers were asking for those kinds of things, but the Germans at Boehringer Mannheim said, oh, no. No real
nine.
nine weeks. And I took the idea back to my friend at Centro and said, you should start your own company. And he said, well, I don't know anything about business, marketing, or sales. And I said, well, maybe I could help you out. So he and I and another gentleman that was working for me as a technical support representative at another biotech company I had moved to in the interim while we were discussing this, the three of us started the company together in 87.
Great.
And it was based on licensing. I think that was your question. None of us were real. I mean, Bill had an idea, but we knew we needed more product. You can't be a one-product company, one-trick pony. So we were constantly looking for new technologies, and I think we licensed them. I mean, it just was so easy back in those days to license things from universities and pharmaceutical companies. And
so that was your main was the kind of that kit.
The first kit was a DNA library construction kit that Bill McConnell was training scientists in his lab to do, and we just started looking for other things that we could license up, and we introduced product about every month or two.
Oh, wow. So very cutting edge then.
It was very cutting
edge. How did you stay abreast of all the new technologies that was coming out of the university system?
Reading papers, going to scientific seminars. Joe Fernandez, the technician that was working for me in customer service at Stratagene, he was a bit of a genius when it came to just understanding what techniques were available and helping scientists like move from one step in molecular biology and genetic engineering to the next step. And he was a kind of an idiot savant at that. He really never learned to comb his hair or tuck in his shirt or match his socks, but he was really on top of that.
You know what's interesting? The whole science of genome and trying to map came from some people from University of San Diego, and there's a conference this week of all the leading people because University of California or San Diego is, which you ended up just because you went to the Navy, has become a hotbed of research in this area.
Yes. Craig Vintner,
Craig
I believe,
Vintner is the one that's speaking.
Yes, he was
this
in
week.
My class.
Okay. Well, by the way, one of the stocks, I bought his original company 20 years ago, and it went from 175 to zero. And I know he's a genius, and his new ventures are working, but I didn't quite do as well as I should have, but he did. He did start.
So you're not loving Craig as much as you could.
He's the real deal.
Yes, he's the real deal. He probably should get the Nobel Prize for what he did.
Yeah, but isn't it ironic that you ended up? I thought I'm not getting as
it
much.
Is.
Of
I didn't know him at school. I didn't meet him until later at an alumni meeting and found out we're in the same class.
So how do the licensing deals work? Because there are many people that kind of come out of UCSB, they have this one product idea, and then they think, well, I can't just be a one-trick pony. How do you go about doing that? How do you make the right connections to do that?
Well, we go to scientific conferences, and we look at posters that graduate students are putting up. And you just, like, scan down, you know, rows and rows of these posters of new techniques. And we're a technique company. We didn't really care what they were doing with this technique, but what we cared about was this is a new technique for purifying DNA, for purifying messenger RNA, for making reverse transcriptase strands, for making extremely long genes out of reverse transcriptase. Just lots of techniques in how to carry on a research program in genetic engineering. And so we would just scan, you know, Joe would walk down the row and just bang, 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 look at a bunch of those posters. And then he would find the grad student and say, oh, how'd you do this? And how is it working? And talk to them about their thing. The universities in those days owned whatever developments but sometimes they wouldn't even bother to patent them. And so by talking to them, you could ask them, well, is this patented? Could we get access to the technology? Could you train people in our lab to do it? If we gave you a royalty to your laboratory, could we use this technology? And we'll handle all the marketing for it. And that's how we would do it. And we ended up being one of the largest licensors and technology owners in America, in the world, in genetic engineering.
Wow.
So companies then who weren't good at marketing could actually come to you.
Yes.
And say, we've got this idea. What do you think?
Yes, we paid royalties. Yes.
Okay, and so basically you had the manpower to market it, and they would just receive it a piece.
It's the manufacturing that is tricky. It's the technical support for the scientists that are using it. It's the packaging. There's a whole, you know, a whole set of things that a scientist doesn't want to be wasting his time with in a university laboratory.
And frankly, that's not their expertise.
Yeah, it's much nicer to just get a check every quarter from Invitrogen.
Now, unlike the current trend, or the trend up until this year, because things are changing back again, you didn't go public right away.
No, we didn't, because I wasn't interested. Well, first of all, my understanding, I mean, I did have that as part of my strategy, but my understanding was you needed to be doing about $40 million a year at this time. That was back in the 80s, 90s. About $40 million a year to support the infrastructure that it takes in accounting and legal and
it's SEC a big undertaking.
Yeah, and so I waited until we were at about $30 million. And when we were at about $25 million, I brought in a mezzanine capital, venture capital firm, who's had taken 60 companies public. And so the whole goal was I put somebody on my board who's got experience in this. I get some guidance from them. I put some cash in the bank.
So was that a tough decision, though, because you went from funding it yourself and really bringing it to then bringing in this level of this mezzanine level of financing, which did you feel like you lost some control in that transaction?
No, I had a business plan, and my business plan was I was driven to be number one in my niche, to define my niche, however it took to be number one in the world in my niche. And then what I wanted to do was bring in other niche technologies. And I did a lot of that with licensing, but I wanted to bring in other niche technologies where I could they dovetailed into my technology so that we could take scientists from step to step to step to step in their entire research program all the way to development of a pharmaceutical. And my plan was to do a roll-up, an industry roll-up. There were a lot of little mom-and-pop shops that had one or two inventions that they brought out to the marketplace, but everyone reaches the end of...
That life cycle,
and I wanted to be there to help roll up the industry. So,
and speaking of the end of the life cycle, we're at the end of the segment, and you're listening to Money Talk on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back.
If you have trouble handling your anger, get help. If someone you love is hurting or scaring you, get help. there is a full-service domestic violence agency in Santa Barbara County, which offers emergency shelter, counseling, transitional housing, anger management, and teen outreach programs. Its name is Domestic Violence Solutions for Santa Barbara County. Call their 24-hour helpline at 964-5245. Domestic Violence Solutions for Santa Barbara County, putting an end to domestic violence.
Did you know that domestic violence sends more than 500 women and children to emergency shelters every year? There is a place where all family members affected by domestic violence can get help. Domestic Violence Solutions for Santa Barbara County, with four 24-hour phone lines to help. In Santa Barbara, call 964-5245. In Santa Maria, call 925-2160. In Lompoc, call 736-0965. And in Santa Ynez, call 686-4390.
The average time a resume spends on an HR manager's desk is 7 seconds, and most of them are tossed aside. Now imagine if one of those resumes belonged to Yasmin, who was
living in a shelter, juggling three jobs. I had to be resilient. That's something that you can't teach.
Or if that resume was from someone who
worked 12-hour shifts at the recycling company with my dad, who's 72. That taught me a work ethic that I carry with me every day.
We rely so much on a resume, yet it could never tell the full story of someone.
Growing up where I did, a lot of things could have gotten in the way of my goals. But I learned to push through, and that's what I bring to work every day.
So maybe it's time we look beyond the resume and look to grads of life. Discover new ways to develop great talent that are so much more than what's on paper at gradsoflife.org. A public service announcement brought to you by Grads of Life and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Lyle Turner, entrepreneur, biochemist, and founder of Invitrogen. So before the break, we were talking about how you, Lyle, and your business, you really set out with a business plan, which I love to hear because so many people start with an idea and then try to fill in a business plan of strategy afterwards as an afterthought. And so the fact that you had that set forth and really, you know, you were targeting your goals or your milestones, and one of them you said was to roll up other companies into yours. Now, how did you go about doing that in terms of you would do the research out in the market, but the negotiation of the deal? Because lots of smaller companies tend to, well, as humans, we tend to overvalue our own companies or our, whatever we created.
Sure.
How did that play out for you?
Well, that's that overvaluing situation, that's an important reason for not using cash, but for using stock, publicly traded stock, as a currency to purchase other companies.
So did you wait until you went public before
I
you started?
I tried a few times because we were pretty successful and we were starting to pile up some cash, and we had targeted companies that had technologies that would fit in well with our flow or our research flow. Our salespeople could sell those products. It would fit nicely in their portfolio. And so we had targeted some companies, but it's just too hard to buy companies with cash. I mean, it takes a long time to save up that much cash. But if you've got public stock that's trading well and doing well, then that's a whole nother ballgame.
Because it's a liquidation event for the founders, and then they have publicly traded stock, and it's not coming just out of your cash war chest.
Yes.
Well, it depends on the multiple, because if it's cheap, the stock, it may be it may not be accretive. So sometimes cash is better, but it depends on the price.
That's correct. Yeah. But we went public in 99, and we were some of the first two bio companies that came out into the marketplace after the crash of the Russian currency and the currency crisis in 97, I thought, is when it started. But went through. So there was no IPOs for a long period of time. And then we were ready, had our prospectus ready, had everything in place in 99, and we were one of the first companies out of the gate. And things really took off in the IPO market, and our multiple stayed very high, and that gave us a good currency for acquisitions. I had when I was doing $100 million a year in sales, I had a $2 billion market cap. I think we were trading at 100 to 1.
Wow.
Which which allowed us to buy the oldest company on the New York Stock Exchange, Dexter. They were founded in 1760, and they were a billion in sales, and they owned 75% of a company that I wanted to buy. And so it was a $2 billion deal totally to buy out both of these companies. And I was only able to do it. I mean, this is a company that's, you know, 13 times our size.
Well, the other story about
and I was able to buy them.
That must have been fun.
Well, it was fun.
And that worked out. But at the same time, there was another one that had the same situation, AOL, that bought Time, which, and, was 50 times bigger and better. And, you know, look what happened there. So you actually worked.
Mine worked.
Sometimes the
due diligence actually helps, probably too.
I think. I mean, I knew what the problems were, and we were quite hard as nails when it came to selling off stuff that and fixing problems and getting things rearranged.
Now, at one point in the company's history, you bought out one of the other founders.
Yes.
How did that work? And because normally partnerships, we say are temporary business arrangements, and it's a difficult and it's an issue that many entrepreneurs face through their life cycle of their companies. How did it work for you? Or share as much as
you're
as
not
you
going to read this in any management books, but he and I got into a scuffle and I.
Well, that's usually what happens, right?
And I held him by the throat
long goodness.
Enough that it left marks on his throat and he pressed charges against me. And so it was not a good working relationship after that.
Understandable.
That's not in any management book I've ever seen.
No. And I wouldn't advise that for anyone listening either.
No.
You can't see Lyle because this is radio. He's a big guy.
Well, and I'm also a very embarrassed guy. That's not one of my proudest moments. It's probably one of my most shameful. But that's how it happened.
Gotcha. And so in looking back, what pearls of wisdom could you or advice would you share with somebody?
Not to
do what you did, but rather how would you have seen that play out a little bit better?
Well, partners are difficult. And as you discussed earlier, it's kind of a marriage, and it was a different way of looking at money and how to handle debt and whether debt was worth taking on for a small company like that. It was a very stressful time for all of us, and we had a new product that was being launched, and we could only buy the raw materials in kilos, and I think it was $20,000 a kilo, and we were going to have to borrow the money for that, and my business partner didn't want to sign his name on any more loans. It was very risky for us.
Right. And it definitely, that definitely goes back to marriage and your risk profile and what you're comfortable with. And
right.
Can you make that leap
right.
together?
Yes.
So you were actually at that point still having to personally sign, or was the company signing?
We were a partnership at that point. We were a closely held partnership, three people.
Which means that you have to have tremendous confidence in your business plan to personally guarantee a loan.
Yes.
So would you say that your company was, switching gears here, was kind of the precursor with the kits? It makes me think of 23andMe, where you spit in the cup and then you send it away and they give you back your genetic makeup.
I believe all those companies are in San Diego, and I believe there's a strong connection to, our history and our culture. And, I mean, we were the largest biotech employer in San Diego when I left. So a lot of my employees spun off and went into other ventures, and 23andMe and Helix.com and a number of those companies are down in San Diego right now.
And what do you think about the research in the 23andMe and how truthful, I guess, when you spit in that cup and send it off, do the results actually come back? Or how reliable would you say that was? Or can you not comment?
Well, I mean, and I... They use algorithms to calculate the probability that you have genetic lines, and the math, can be flexible.
It's not 100%. There's a statistical analysis of it's probably 80% accurate.
You have to ask them what percentage it is, but I know that, I wouldn't be taking a lot of money to the bank based on that.
So when
so when it comes back as, you know, we're British royalty or something, don't count on that.
But here's the thing: my skepticism was raised when I had my new dog Mutt's DNA tested, and they asked for a picture of him. I thought that was a little bit aggressive.
I can tell her what breed he is based on that.
Yeah, just the
technology.
Picture.
That's right.
So one of the things that I have to ask is, your industry, it's when you tell your story, it sounds like you were the big guy just pushing people around, but you were a little guy, and you were pushing the big guys around. You were in a playing field. Maybe it wasn't as big as it is today, but it certainly was a competitive area. So you had to deal with some pretty big players out there when you were working, didn't you? I mean, weren't you?
Yes.
You were the small guy in town.
Yes, that company we bought, Life Technologies, was four times our size, and that was that year. When I took my company from $33 million at the end of 1998 and took it public in February of 99. I did my first acquisition in June, and I did another financing, another stock offering at the end of the year, and I did my second acquisition in February of the next year. So within 12 months, I'd done two acquisitions and two major financings, an IPO and a secondary. And I went back and I got some more. I did a $175 million bond offering. And then I used that to buy this, to set up this deal for Dexter Life Technologies. And yeah, I was a little guy stepping into the ring with the big guys.
Isn't that very unusual?
I would say, you know, yeah. And when we talked about this at the time, yeah, it was unusual. But there was a Green Meal campaign to take over Dexter. A guy named Sam Heyman, who had done.
Oh yeah.
Oh, you know Sam?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was on Wall Street for many years.
Ah.
And as soon as you said Green Mail, I knew what you were talking about.
Yeah, I stood toe to toe with Sam, and Sam was a pro, and yeah. Sam was, you know, yeah. He was the Gordon Gekko yeah. of, or one of the Gordon Gekkos of.
Well, the Carl Icahn yeah. of then.
Yeah, of special chemicals. Yeah. And so I went toe-to-toe with Sam in a room and talked him into allowing me, because he wanted to do the same deal I did. He wanted to buy Dexter. There was one section of Dexter that he wanted. He wanted to sell Life Technologies to somebody like me for the highest price and then end up with that section for free. Well, that's what I ended up doing. I pushed Sam out of it. I made a tender offer better than his. I took over Dexter. I chopped up Dexter into three parts. It was all sold by the time I closed the deal, and I walked away. Dexter was gone. I made money on Dexter, and what I paid for LifeTech was stock, basically. And so I ended up with more money in the bank after the deal than I had when I went into the deal.
Wow, that is very Gordon Gekko.
Yeah, it was. It was quite unusual.
You're listening to Money Talk, and that is a great place to use the word Money Talk. That
Absolutely.
Was Money Talking. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Hospice of Santa Barbara is there to help when we're adjusting to living with a life-threatening illness, facing death, anticipating the death of a loved one, or healing our grief after a death. Hospice of Santa Barbara can provide the emotional, social, and spiritual care needed in a supportive, compassionate environment. Hospice of Santa Barbara provides professional counseling for individuals and has many support groups and programs for adults, teens, and children. Services are free, made possible by our community's generosity and by all of the highly trained, wonderful volunteers that give of their time to help those in need. If you would like to make a donation, become a volunteer, or support the important work of Hospice of Santa Barbara, or find out more about hospice services for you or someone you love, please call 563-8820, 563-8820, or visit our website at www.hospiceofsantabarbara.org.
Hey, there he is. How's it going?
I'm having a stroke.
Are you going to shake my hand or what?
I'm having a stroke.
Wow, you're not even moving your arm.
I'm having a stroke.
Are you okay?
I'm having a stroke.
Your face looks weird, too.
I'm having a stroke.
Are you having a seizure or something?
I'm having a stroke.
When someone is having a stroke, they may not be able to say it with words, but their body language will tell you loud and clear.
I'm having a stroke.
You just need to know the sudden signs. Look for FAST, F-A-S-T. F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. Or S, speech difficulty. Then T, time. Time to call 911 immediately. Because the sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in their recovery. Know the sudden signs. Face, arm, speech, time. Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Almaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara, and your home court.
It is my home court. It's everyone's home court, though, in Santa Barbara. Yeah.
Bocce court.
Bocce court, yes. So if you're just joining us, if you missed the last segment, you missed a great conversation about what Lyle actually did in the biotech industry. I got to ask, though, as the little guy on the block, how did you manage to get yourself in that position and have the confidence to be able to go against kind of the greats of the Gordon Geckos and beat them? What do you think? What gave you that one up?
Well, I'm not sure I had the confidence, but
well, you must have because you won.
Yes.
Did you look at it as like playing a game? Or
I did. It was an extremely exciting, you know, four.
I'm excited just hearing about it.
It's an extremely exciting four-dimensional chess game, in that particular story, but I knew that it was a game changer for my company. Because we had great technology. I thought that LifeTech had been mismanaged by Dexter for a lot of years, and I thought that I could fix their problems. They had great technology that fit in extremely well with mine, and they also had a couple of very strong niche-leading products. Gibco was, they're still the number one cell culture company in the world, and that's probably... You know, they had some other niche leaders that fit into my product line, but Gibco was just a great name in biotechnology that has its toe in every biologically produced pharmaceutical that comes out of the FDA now, through the FDA. And so that's like...
It's like gold.
It's like gold. They have to keep buying that stuff from you as long as that pharmaceutical is in production. It's a wonderful thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have to look at your current activities, which are, again, from my standpoint, a New Yorker, type of risky vocations. You're a extreme sport person as far as I can see. Maybe you don't think of it as extreme, but if you look at some of the pictures on the web, you're out there. You're doing mountain climbing. You're doing all kinds of – you flew a plane someplace that I wouldn't even want to think about.
I've flown around the world. I've done world flights.
You've done some extreme things. Do you think that personality and ability to take risk is part of the reason you were able to succeed in business?
Yes, I didn't know that about myself, but I got a high from mergers and acquisitions. I got a high from business. I don't know how to explain it, but you have those white Zen moments in business where you can see all the chess pieces and it looks clear. And I mean, maybe it's delusional, but it's just so fun to feel like you're in that kind of a game and winning at a game at that level.
So how did you part of, I guess the answer is what Neil just asked you, but how did you transition into retirement, from going from that high stakes game?
Well, that's part of the way I did it. When I retired, I went to Canada and I did cross country skiing and downhill skiing for 3 months. And then I went down to Costa Rica and I took Spanish and surfing classes for 3 months, and then I got on my bicycle and I bicycled around Alaska and biked 4,000 miles down to San Francisco. And I felt like, first of all, I didn't want to think about business. I had been so obsessive about that for so many years that I just wanted to think about something else and not think about business. And being totally immersed in something like that, I got my commercial pilot's license when I came back from the bicycle trip. I just stayed as busy as I could trying to see what other opportunities there were in life that were interesting. And that's how I transitioned. I just, you know, dug into.
You took all that adrenaline and put it into.
So the lesson here is to work hard, become as educated as you can, take incredible risks in business, and then see if you can kill yourself.
No. I'm a very careful guy. I'm not trying to get hurt.
My view is, you know, I would, you know, do extreme.
You do
hike.
Radio shows.
No, I would hire someone to hike for me in Alaska.
Send me some pictures.
Right. So, let me know how it went.
So now, what do you do? What do you do with your time now? I know that you're involved with the Global Reef Project.
Not so much. I gave my boat to Sea Shepherd this summer, and I donated
it. So what's Sea Shepherd?
Sea Shepherd is a whaling organization that spun off from Sierra Club. No, is it Sierra Club? No, what's the other whaling anti-whaling organization? Is it Sierra Club? Greenpeace. Thank you, sir. Yeah. Thank you for stepping in there and helping out there. Greenpeace, the founder of Greenpeace thought that Greenpeace had gotten too wimpy, and so he spun off Sea Shepherd, and he has T-shirts of how many ships they've rammed and how many ships they've sunk, and he's had to stop doing that because he was tried in international courts, and he had to promise he'd do no more rammings, but now he takes drones out and he films them doing illegal fishing and whaling and things. He's been instrumental, I think, in... There's a television show that you may have seen, Whale Wars. I don't know if anybody's heard
of
that.
Okay. And so how do you keep busy now?
Oh, so now
where do you get that adrenaline rush now?
Yeah, I'm really not getting it. I try to control myself and not kill my son. That's where I get my adrenaline rush now. My whole day is based on cooking breakfast and getting him to school on time, and then cleaning up the house before he gets home in the afternoon.
So then he can destroy it again and do it all over again.
No, that's a big change in rhythm for me. But it was what I wanted. It was what I thought I had missed in my obsessive pursuit of career goals. And
that's a great question for you. Do you think that there's any such thing as work-life balance? You know, you go to all these conferences and they talk about
there wasn't in my
balance.
Life. But I was obsessive. I mean, and I was terrified of failure. And that's, you know, one of the things that I think contributed to my obsession was I just couldn't imagine failing and having to start over again. So
you kept it going. And
so I kept it going. But that sucks the life out of you, and there's a price that you pay in your life for those things. So for me, no work-life balance. This is the way I had to balance it. Stop, start doing something else, and... Focus on it.
So
you're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
Hey, at our startup, my team and I move at the speed of tech 24/7. And every single day, it's information overload. It's coming at me from all directions. And you know what? Bottom line, I just need the news that matters. So where do I turn? Local radio and TV. I want to hear from people who live and work in my town. They give me the real story with information I know I can rely on. So where else can I find out what's happening in my community? Weather and traffic, things that affect my family and my business. I want to stay informed by sources I trust, my local radio and TV stations. for the best entertainment, sports, news, traffic, and weather with no agenda and more reliable than other platforms. So if you ask me for the information I want anytime, anywhere, I stay local. Support your local station. Text radio to 52886 today. Furnished by the NAB and this station. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
So, Lyle, as the founder of Invitrogen, how did you go about deciding when it was time to sell to another company and really transition out? What did that look like for you? Because it had to have been a very deliberate decision, given how you were going and with what pace and energy and focus you had with that.
The company didn't sell until long after I was gone. When the stock market took a dive, the NASDAQ dropped from 5,000 down to 1,700 or something in late 2001, I believe.
9/11.
It took a while for it to make it down. So it might have been 2002, I think, when the S&P and the NASDAQ hit the bottom. I had a board that was telling me that I needed to do something to get the value of the stock back up because all of their options were underwater. And I said, you know, we are the biggest, fastest growing, most profitable business in our industry. I think we have a pretty good business plan. I don't think any books tell you that you need to change your business plan to get the stock up. And the stock was down on every company and the
right.
All
it was
the indexes.
It was across the board.
Yeah, and so you could, you know, I could have
stood on your head. It wouldn't matter.
Yeah, golden things could have come out of every orifice, and it wouldn't have fixed the problem. So I just said, no, you just have to be steady and hold on to this. We're profitable. We're making money hand over fist. We're growing fast. Our customers love us. You know, we shouldn't be messing with this. But they wanted more. And I think that I had created some other problems with people on the board from companies I had purchased and digested their companies and done things a little that they didn't like. But anyway, I just said, if you need to do these things, I mean, I took a long talk with myself and I thought that the company was changing in a way that most of the fun things I wanted to do, the IPO, the mergers and acquisitions, creating the true leader in our industry, those things were kind of behind me. And what I could see was I needed to just to keep turning the crank on other acquisitions and, you know, improving costs and managing things, which that wasn't really the fun for
so
me.
So it kind of turned into that management role of managing people, managing costs.
Yeah, and I was
going to
be managing a board that I wasn't, I didn't think they were on the same page as I was. So they said, well, we're going to find somebody else. And I said, okay, then I'll be winding up my affairs. And I packed up my office and
this is a problem that.